You're listening to The Corbett Report. CorbettReport.com.
3, 2, 1. All right. Welcome, my friends. Welcome to episode 283 of The Corbett Report. I'm your host, as always, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you from the sunny climes of Western Japan, in the shade of the outdoors, for those of you watching the video version of this podcast, because in episode 283, we're going to be discussing how to make media. This is, of course, one of those questions that I've had in various forms over the years, many, many, many times, through the contact form on CorbettReport.com, and I have attempted my best to answer this question, and in fact, there was even a previous edition of Corbett Report Radio in which we did talk about some of the software and audio setup, etc., that I'm using, so I will throw the link to that in the show notes for today's episode of the podcast so you can go back and refer to that. There's a lot of information in there on the technical side, but today we're going to have more of a wide-ranging conversation. We're going to tackle some of the questions that have come in the last few weeks on this specific topic through the contact form on CorbettReport.com. We have compiled quite a list of questions, and some of them are basically the same questions, so we're going to mix and match them together. But in order to help do this today, I have a very, very, very unusual special treat for all of you out there today. It's not just going to be listening to me ramble on ad nauseum for an hour. Today we are joined by a special guest right here in the sunny climes of Western Japan. Of course, you probably all know him by now, Brock West of APPerspective.net, and of course the co-host of Asia Pacific Perspective. So we are here live in the sunny climes of Western Japan. Brock, you are here in Japan once again. You were here last year very briefly. We met for one afternoon, and there was a subscriber-only video that we were in.
That's right, yeah.
But this is the first time I have ever done a podcast with someone, so welcome to the podcast.
Arigato gozaimasu. Very happy to be here. To say it's an honor to be on the Corbett Report is a huge understatement, and yeah, doesn't time fly in a year? You know, you've become a proud father, you and your lovely wife.
Yes.
I was lucky enough to just earlier meet your adorable son, so thank you very much for that. And on my side, you know, I conducted a survey between myself and my mother, and apparently I'm even more good looking this year, so... Win-win.
I can attest. For those of you who aren't getting the full glory of his visage in the video version of this podcast, of course, which is available on the YouTube channel and on CorbettReport.com if you're just listening to the audio. And, of course, this is an audio podcast first and foremost, so we will stick to the audio version. But there are some actual physical setup of what I do that I want to show you in some form or another, so I'll probably be recording some video footage of that to put up on the specifically as a video later. We'll show you maybe a bit of that as an overlay on this video podcast, but we'll try to keep it to just our conversation. And I wanted to have a bit of a conversation today, Brock, rather than just ramble on with my mad ramblings, or just question and answer. I mean, I think we should talk a little bit about the process of creating media, because this is something that I've talked about time and time again on my podcast. And to me, it really is very important that this work that I'm doing is not just me sitting here talking to a screen, talking to a camera, and people sitting at home just imbibing it. I desperately want this to be an idea that other people take on and start to use for themselves, because I know personally that the most important thing I've ever done is stop being an audience member and start being an active participant in this conversation. And I never in a million years would have imagined I'd be sitting here doing this as a full-time profession. It's absolutely incredible. And it is just a testament to what an average person with average resources can do if you go out there and actually do it. And it's so important to break down that barrier that has held us back in the audience for literally centuries. The technology to be able to disseminate our information to the four corners of the world has never really existed in the way that it does now. So let's make the most of it. And it is actually a lot easier than you think. And that's what I want to start hopefully demonstrating today by answering some of these questions. I know you have some questions. There were some questions that came in. But perhaps first we could start actually just talking a little bit about your own situation, because I know you've kind of gotten into this relatively recently with Asia Pacific Perspective. Yeah. Let's talk about the website side of this, because this is, I think, the first standard entry point for people. I think people would be surprised to have never tried just how easy it is to set up a blog these days, especially with the free blogging services. Mm-hmm. Tell us about AP Perspective and how you went about setting that up.
Well, I mean, honestly, the first thing is that I took your advice and, you know, out of all the amazing information that you've given your subscribers and your audience over the years, whether it be about false flag terror or the fiat currency system or the monetary system, so on and so forth, one of the things that really stood out to me was, yeah, I can do this too. And, you know, as a J6-back, like we all are still, you know, we're all just normal people, it is exceptionally easy, deceptively easy, to create your own website and to build it up slowly but surely. Just from my perspective, on Asia-Pacific perspective, I literally just run it out of Blogger, which is a free, fairly user-friendly blogging site. And I'm lucky enough to have an awesome graphic designer in my home as my wife. So that does help in, you know, prettying up the site a little bit. But there is great templates that you can use for that. And, of course, there's also other ones. Most famous, I guess, would be WordPress as well, which is what we run FukushimaUpdate.com off.
So, yes, and Corbett Report.
And Corbett Report as well. So basically, that's the first place to start, and that's where I started. And, yeah, it kind of went from there.
Exactly. Mm. And for people who are interested, I'm sure, I have never looked, but I'm sure there are a million tutorials on how to set up an easy blogger site.
Absolutely, yeah. Just, you know, YouTube it and take your pick, basically.
Exactly. It is much easier than you think, and it's completely free if you want to do it the free way, right?
Exactly right. I still have not put a cent into the website itself. Of course, there's a little bit of software, which we'll get into a little bit later in the podcast, that you can choose to buy, but there's also great free alternatives out there as well. So this is definitely not anything for the rich man.
And that was always my favorite criticism that I received from DSmog blog when I started climategate.tv, which, by the way, for people out there who have been looking to that recently, is now a defunct website. I gave up that URL. But back when I started climategate.tv, DSmog blog, which is this place that goes around and says that everyone who disbelieves in man-made global warming is paid by the oil companies, they said, the climate deniers have started a new TV channel, which was actually a website, so I'm not sure what they were talking about, talking about climategate.tv, and they said, look at the funding they must have in order to do this. And it was literally a free template WordPress website that I set up in about 10 minutes that I paid, I think, $5 a month for hosting on GoDaddy. So it was it was just ridiculous to hear that I must be secretly paid by the oil companies in order to run a site like that, which only goes to show that either they think you are too stupid to be able to figure this out, and or B, they just actually don't know what they're talking about. But since they have a website, I'm assuming they probably know that it's pretty easy to do. So my message is the exact opposite. Whether you agree with me, whether you disagree with me, violently disagree with me, whether you think I'm a shill, gatekeepers, reptile, Zionist, CIA, Vatican overlord, or whatever you think I am, well, I invite you, I urge you, please get into the game. Start doing this for yourself. Start joining the conversation. And I really believe it's only through all of us joining this conversation that we will start to steer it in a more positive direction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're all the best armchair critics at the best of times. But if you really want to if you really want to walk the walk and talk the talk, you know, get your own information out there through a website or a blog that is your own, that you are completely in control of, which is affordable. And then, bring it to the table, and that's when you'll really start to engage, I feel, anyway.
That's it. And again, it's really easy, and I hope we're going to demonstrate that today. So why don't we get into some of the questions and start pounding back some of the answers?
Absolutely. Well, we've got some great questions here that flooded into your inbox, James. We'll take this first one from Brooks. I'm especially interested in your technique of staying so eloquently on topic as you're speaking into the camera. Do you use a teleprompter software / setup of any kind, or what's your secret? This is a great question. It's something, I'm still only about a year into this. You were at least 7 years now?
Six and a half.
I am amazed when we do Asia Pacific Perspective all your other works, especially the podcast, how eloquently and seamlessly you seem to do it. But, I mean, is it just experience and practice?
It's exactly what it is, because trust me, for anyone who caught my first podcasts, the first ever podcast I did actually was mostly scripted. I actually had a script written out ahead of time, because it was the first time I'd done anything like that. And even so, it still sounded atrocious. So I always urge people not to start from episode one if you're just new to the Corbett Report. But yes, I started out with that, but I quickly got rid of that by, I think, episode 3. I barely just had notes that I was going through as I was doing the podcast. And at this point, yes, I am able to talk without prompting. Is there a teleprompter here behind the scenes somewhere? No. So it really is experience and just doing it year after year and challenging yourself a little bit further each time. As we were talking about before we started rolling here, back when I was doing the audio-only version of the podcast, I had the luxury of, if I made a silly mistake in my grammar or whatever, I could just stop, go back, edit it back out or in. When I'm doing video, it's obviously much more difficult to do that, so I have basically trained myself to be able to speak extemporaneously, even using words like extemporaneously, woo. But again, that is truly just from practice, and now after 6.5 years, it really is kind of second nature to talk like this. So it actually makes conversations with real-life human beings more difficult, maybe.
Yeah.
But on the prompter side of things, when I do the eye-opener reports and the GRTV backgrounders, I'm sure people notice that I'm reading from a script on that. That is through a teleprompter-type thing that I have set up. And teleprompter, I just mean I have a cheapo laptop that I have lying around that has a free software on it. I believe it is called Teleprompter, but I'll put the link in so you can download it for yourself. It's a Windows laptop, so it's a Windows-based program. And I just set that up literally physically right behind my camera, and it just scrolls by with the text, and I just read it like that, and it works. I think it works better than a lot of other setups I've seen, even on YouTube. I've seen a lot of cheapo news-type operations, like do-it-yourself operations, but I'm not sure how they're doing it, but they don't seem to have it set up in a convenient way, so you can tell they're kind of looking off and reading a script. But the way mine is set up, it's just literally right behind the camera, and it just scrolls right by, so it's quite easy to do. So that is one possible route, but honestly, I think the best way to communicate is off the cuff.
Absolutely. Just from my personal experience, when we recorded the first appearance I had on Corbett Report Radio, I literally had pages and pages and pages of notes, and once you do start, if you choose to go down the interviewing podcasting route, which I hope you all do, you'll be amazed how quickly time flies. You think you won't possibly have enough notes, but, in those first couple of episodes we did on Corbett Report Radio, I barely scratched the surface of the notes I had. So as we've become more regular doing Asia Pacific Perspective, almost every time now it shortens to bullet points, and I'm finding with, constantly doing the work that I do on AP Perspective, it's just, I can start, the cogs in the old brain start to tick over much, much more seamlessly, so yeah. It's just a matter of practice.
Yeah, I agree. And you're exactly right. That was the one thing I always told guests on Corbett Report Radio, especially like first time on the radio type guests, it's going to be an hour, I can't speak that much.
Yeah.
It flies by. You wouldn't even believe. And I think you're right. I would urge people, if they were going to do something like this, especially if you're going to be an interview guest or something, just make point form notes of the details, like names, places, dates, things that you'll probably forget when you're speaking, so you can refer to it, and then just speak around that. And I think that's probably the easiest way to do it. Again, it's just practice.
Yeah, that's the route that myself and Hanul Navi and Mike Bilowski from The Last Defense do when we do our monthly podcast. Essentially, we cover three topics throughout the interview, and each one of us has an article or topic to do their own research on, and they just make a very brief Word document about the bullet points of the article that they want to discuss. It's a very simple, foolproof way to, just have some backup there, just in case you do stumble into a language corner like we all do sometimes.
Absolutely. Even the best of us.
Yes.
All right. I think we've got that one under control.
Brilliant.
Next question.
Moving on. This is a brilliant question from Sophia. So, Sophia, thank you very much. This is something that I've also wanted to ask James, so I'm glad to be here doing it in person. How and why should blogger/investigator/outlet types collaborate? Shouldn't we all be part of a growing but loose and amorphous network? And in the face of the great NSA eye in the sky, what are the real risks to people like us?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a question I've gotten a lot in different ways from different people over the years, and I'm sure everyone thinks about these issues. As for the how bloggers should come together and instead of just being amorphous, I think I have a different take than a lot of people, because I've noticed time and time and time again with the people I work with, everyone always says we should have one site that everyone goes to. I think that the nature of the internet revolution is of the opposite, in the opposite direction. We have been conditioned for generations to believe that we need all of our information in that one form, in that one place. And it used to be a physical newspaper or magazine or whatever where you would get a lot of information, and it would be kind of the curator of that information, the editor that would bring the best information and the best writers and whatever to you. And that made sense when it was a physical object that you had to go, you know, ship halfway around the world or whatever. Now that we have this instantaneous connection directly from a human being to another human being who has a website, I don't think we need that congregation spot in the same way that we did before. And in some ways, my philosophy is that the power of what we are doing is that it is amorphous to a certain extent. I think whenever you have a movement, whenever you have a website, whenever you have a place where a bunch of different people congregate, it can be co-opted, it can be controlled, there can be you can decapitate it by taking out a key figure, you can undermine it by putting in cognitive infiltrators or the like.
Occupy Wall Street's a perfect example of that, I would say.
There's a lot to say about that. But that's one example, right? And so they were trying to work from a consensus template.
Sure.
And how are you going to get anything larger than a group of four or five people to work on consensus?
It's, even then.
Yeah, even then, right? And exactly. And the point of the internet revolution to me is I have a website, I can say whatever I want, and I don't have to be beholden to anyone else or think about what anyone else is going to think about it. It is me, 100% raw. This is what I believe, this is what I've found in my research, this is what I'm putting forward. Nobody has the say or control over what I do. If we start congregating in those types of websites, then, you know, person A says something and person B says, you can't say that, I don't want to be associated with that, you have infighting, you have all of that kind of nonsense. I prefer it the way it is, and people can, I have faith and trust in people out there to be able to pick and choose and be their own editors, be your own curator. If you like what someone else is saying and what someone else is saying and what someone else is saying, you can bring that together just as easily as anyone else could, and there doesn't need to be that one website that everyone goes to. I understand the appeal of it, and I understand the idea that maybe you could point some outsider to, hey, here's the website, check it out, and everyone that I love is on this website. I understand the appeal of that idea, but I still think it's more powerful for us to be the lone wolves, because we can. We, for the first time in history, we can be.
Do you think anything like a alternative news only search engine is ever kind of an idea or possible, or would it work? Or
To have news websites like Blacklisted News or whatever that are alternative news and congregate from different places, that's great. But again, I don't want to put all my eggs in any one basket. Why do that when we could have the selection? An alternative news search engine, just to me, that seems a bit arbitrary. I like having a search engine that will give me everything, including the mainstream crap, because I want to know what they're thinking as well. I don't want to shut myself off or be that kind of, have that wall between us.
Yeah, well, I find, you know, through the RSS feeds, which we'll get into a little bit later, but when I do post mainstream articles on my website, it does often, you know, will have important information. But what's also great is then you can counteract that with related articles like I do. I remember there was an article going on, I was talking about Fukushima, with getting all these experts in, and I just thought, well, we're all listening to these experts, and it just went off in my head that the podcast episode you did about expertology.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great way to also provide a counterbalance as well, and, you know, you are using the mainstream in that way. So.
Exactly right. Yeah, no, I don't think we should be ignoring the mainstream. The crap that they're putting out needs to be counteracted, and we have to understand what the vector of the propaganda is so we can do that effectively.
Absolutely. Okay, this is probably, I would say, the most common question that we got over the last couple of weeks. James, which software do you use for video creation? What other platform would you recommend to spread multiple sources? Eventually, I think I will switch and leave Facebook. Well, please leave Facebook.
Yeah. I certainly don't recommend anyone ever create a Facebook profile. If you have one and you want to use it to disseminate information, well, why not? But
From experience, I was on Facebook a couple of years ago, and I was putting out, you know, links to your work and Media Monarchy and New World Next Week and there and thereafter, and no one seems... Facebook, I don't think, is really meant for that, or people on Facebook don't really care about that, I think, if you really want to get to the harder stuff. I mean, you and I both have Twitter accounts. I have two of them, AP Perspective and my own. I mean, that's a great, fast way to do it, but of course, you know, there's downsides to that as well, so... So what are the software secrets that you can enlighten us on?
For video specifically, I use Final Cut Pro, And that is one of the bigger expenses of anything that you'd be using if you were using my setup. But first of all, I want to stress that I'm not saying that my setup is the way to go. There's lots of software out there, so I'm just telling you what I use. And in fact, several years ago when I was running the entire website off of my old beat-up, clunky, secondhand laptop, I was using, I think, Sony Vegas Pro, something like that. I got it for like $80 online. So you can get anything from the free Movie Maker, iMovie software, all the way up to expensive, you know, Final Cut and After Effects and all that stuff. I personally use Final Cut Pro for my video editing. It works well for me. But in terms of, also I guess we should cover audio software while we're at it. I just use the free freeware. It's called Audacity. You can record multiple tracks, edit very easily. It does what I need it to do. I know there's fancy software out there that some people use, but it's free. Why not?
And it's simple. I've only just started using it quite recently, and I'm not a tech geek by any stretch of the imagination, but yeah, Audacity is really user-friendly.
Yep.
And free.
It's intuitive, it's user-friendly, it's free. The only other thing that I would supplement that with is a program called Levelator, which is one of the best things that I ever invested in. It's, again, free, so I didn't pay a cent for it, but you can download it for free, and it normalizes the levels in your audio. So if you have different sources that are coming in at different levels, one's really loud, one's really quiet, whatever, you can physically go through and adjust it all in Audacity, but that's a ridiculously time-consuming process, and I used to do that before I found Levelator, and then you just stick a WAV file into Levelator, and it does it all automatically. It's does it whatever magic it does, and it comes out the other side sounding all the same levels. So that's nice and friendly on your listeners, because once again, I think that's probably that's the number one priority for me, is this going to make a better experience for the listener or viewer? I don't care about bells and whistles unless it's just easier for the, if it's nicer on the eyes or in the ears of the listener and viewer.
Sure. Video recording.
Video recording, the physical recording, well, there's a couple of things. Well, I have my old standard HV30 video camera, which is actually a tape camera, an old camcorder. That does the trick, and if you're watching the video of this, you're watching Brock on that camera right now, and I have just invested, thanks to the support of people out there, buying, for example, the new 2011 Video Archive DVD. Thank you so much for your support, and with that money, I have just invested in a brand new Canon 70D DSLR camera, hot off the presses. It is a brand new camera, and it looks beautiful, I think, compared to the HV30. And that is what you're looking at me on right now if you're watching the video of this podcast. So those are the physical devices that I use for recording. And the other factor of video recording is how you record the audio. And I think audio is more important than the video itself. You could be recording on a potato, but if it has good audio, then it's still at least usable as media. But other way around, you can have the most beautiful DSLR with a beautiful lens on your camera, and if you have crappy audio, no one's going to watch the video. So audio is the most important thing, and it can be a real headache, and it's the type of thing where that actually costs a little bit of money to try to get something that sounds good. And so right now, I'll just tell you about the setup, and maybe we can show you it on the video later. But basically, right now, we're using a Zoom H6, which is has XLR inputs. It also has a recording. It records the audio of the video that you're watching separately. I have a lavalier microphone. It's an AT-8020. I forget the make, but I'll put a link in the show notes so that you can check it out. It's pretty cheap as far as lavalier mics go, and it works pretty well. And Brock is talking on a Shure SM58 mic, one of your standard kind of vocal mics for you might see your local band performing with.
The musician's choice.
There you go. And you are a musician yourself. So.
Sort of.
I try. So he just played a little guitar for me, and trust me, he's much better than me. So that's the setup we're using. There's also a shotgun microphone on the HV30. So there's lots of things to say about recording audio and video, but whatever you use, I think my number one suggestion would be don't use the internal mic on the camera. If you can afford any type of microphone, a shotgun mic or whatever you can mount on the camera, or if you can get XLR inputs with a juiced link or something that's got pure XLR audio, then that's the way to go. Because once again, audio is the most important part of this media.
Excellent. Well, okay, so We've got our blogger, we've got our WordPress, just at the basis anyway. We've got a name, we've got some good ideas for recording audio, video, video editing software. Okay, so we've got our website essentially set up. Now we want to spread the word. And not just on your own website, but also throughout, you know, YouTube and Twitter and Google Plus, if you want to use Google or whatever, you know, that's very important, obviously, and especially, I mean, your YouTube channel is a massive part of a corporate report now. Mm-hmm. It's a great way for people to view your media instead of finding a standalone website. And when I started my YouTube channel a few months ago, I, out of the blue, got a huge message from the one and only Vinnie Eastwood of VinnieEastwoodShow.com, who I know you've had on the show, and you've been on his show a couple of times. And he literally gave me point-by-point ways to improve your, not just your YouTube channel, but your blogger or your WordPress or your website hit lists or traffic in general. So let's just knock a few of these down, and these are really great, very common sense bullet points. So find a topic for your channel. For example, you can do what a lot of folks are doing already and start some kind of video blog, buy a cheap camera and start recording yourself. You can share your own personal experiences, your philosophy and your thoughts. As we discussed before, write a brief script before recording a video. Be passionate and energetic. I think that's a huge one, you know, and that also does take a little bit of time to kind of mm-hmm. start bringing your own inflections and mm-hmm. personal ideas in. You know, even if people go back to the first episodes of New World Next Week, for example, mm-hmm. compared to what they are now, not that they were bad back then, but now
they weren't as good.
Yeah, but now you guys have such a knack for, you know, really giving your own personal spin on it, and people can take it or leave it as they see fit. Next one, treat your channel like a blog by uploading videos on a regular basis. Now, this is a big point in my opinion. If you do want to generate traffic and you do want to slowly but surely build a base audience, you know, you really do have to keep at it. You know, posting a video once every couple of months really isn't going to generate that interest, you know what I mean? And I've found myself throughout the year or so that AP Perspective has been up and running that, you know, the more and more I do, the more and more people who are coming to the site, you know, and I start getting a little bit anxious now when I haven't got enough up on the website
right.
in a given day,
yeah.
you know, so.
It is a beast you have to keep feeding, but you do have to keep feeding it if you want it, that audience, and that's exactly why New World Next Week comes out on the same day every week, so
that's
people
right.
know it's Thursday, it's time for New World Next Week.
Exactly. Okay, this is a word we've had a lot of recently with the NSA. Optimize your metadata. Descriptions, tags, and titles. By using descriptive keywords, some people use adjectives when searching for videos on YouTube. Mm. James, your thoughts on that?
It's true. I always put tags in my videos on YouTube. I have no idea if it helps, but I always put tags in because I think it probably does help with the searching. And I've actually found several times in the past where I've been searching for a very specific topic, and I type the words that I think would be the best search words into the YouTube search engine. First thing that comes up is one of my previous videos. So that's a good experience, yeah.
Okay, take the time to select the right thumbnail for every video. This is something you have kind of been schooling me on a little bit lately. So how do you go about creating good thumbnails?
Yeah, that's a good question. Still, it's kind of hit and miss, and it's an experiment. I've only had the feature to customize thumbnails in YouTube for a little while. They weren't allowing me to do that before because YouTube hates me. But now that I can do that, I'm trying to put up custom thumbnails that will draw people's attention. Again, I know the regular listeners and viewers don't care, but for new people who are maybe just scrolling through a bunch of YouTube search results, it can be the difference between them clicking and not clicking. So here's a story that I've never told. It's kind of funny. I remember way back at the very beginning of the Corbett Report when I started my YouTube channel 6.5 years ago now or whatever it was. I was thinking about this type of thing, and I was thinking at that time it was always the thumbnail on the video was always the exact center of the video. Mm-hmm. And so there were people who... Sync again, 3, 2, 1. All right, well, here we are.
We are back.
There was a slight interruption in our recording there, as you may have noticed. We just had an interesting technical difficulty, and rather than cutting it out and not showing you behind the scenes, why don't we explain what actually happened? We were recording with our three cameras here, and one of them ran out of batteries while we were talking, so we had to cut short. And here we are back again after a bit of fun going back to get one of the parts to change the battery out. And now some children are playing in this park where we're recording. So there will be some pleasant, dulcet tones of little children screaming in our ear. But before we cut off, I was just explaining a little story about when I started the Corbett Report, and I was talking about the YouTube thumbnail. The automatic thumbnail was always the dead center of the video, so some people gamed it by putting a picture in just in that center that was very different from the rest of the video just to draw people's attention. I toyed with that idea, and I thought, well, if I put a picture of a woman in a bikini in the center, then everyone will click on it, and it'll actually be about 9/11 truth, and I'll trick people into learning the truth. And I decided against that, and that is one of the best decisions I ever made, because clearly, if we are about spreading a message of truth, then tricking people into getting that message is not going to win us any friends in the long run. And I don't think that deception is a good part of this game, as it were. So absolutely, I've thought about this before as well. I think everyone probably does. And hey, I'm not here telling anyone what to do. You do whatever you want, feel you want to do. But just for myself, I've decided not to go down that route. So I hope that the visuals that I use for thumbnails are interesting, but I hope they're not deceptive either.
Sure. Well, yeah, once again, a big thank you to Vinny Eastwood for sending me this through my YouTube channel. These are some great points, and there's a lot more there, so we might put them in the show notes as well. Back to some of your subscriber questions, James. This comes from Dennis. I was wondering what technology / items you use when making your last word reports. For example, what type of camera do you use? And I would like to add to this question, James, how do you go about effectively using the green screen for your GRTV eye-opener reports?
Right, yes. For the GRTV backgrounders, the eye-openers, for the last word, you'll notice that I have a fancy studio background that's accomplished, obviously, through green screen, which is a rather magnificent title for what I actually do. I have, as I showed you earlier, just a little green piece of fabric, a little curtain thing that I hang up on the wall behind me. I'll show you some video of that in the video version of this podcast. I think it literally cost about $2 or $3 to buy that piece of fabric, and just using Final Cut Pro, you use something called chroma keying. Again, there's a million tutorials online about how to do it, and that's how I learned. I taught myself, and I don't do a very good job of it, but it's good enough. Good enough for podcasting, as they say. At any rate, it's trial and error, and it really only does cost a few dollars for the stuff. The most expensive part of that equation would be the software.
Sure. So. And a little secret tidbit here. James actually makes his green screen out of Oompa Loompa hair. And he demands a fresh one every single report.
You're not supposed to tell them about that.
I've got to say, they're looking a little bit skinny, James. You can't see them.
Yeah. I've been accused of Oompa Loompa abuse, but we'll keep those reports under the rug.
All right. If I may indulge your listeners and yourself, I have a few questions that I would like to ask.
Please do. Fire away.
Rattling in the back of the old brain for the last couple of years, where do you acquire your bumper / intro music for the Corbett Report podcasts?
Good question. That was something that I got from a stock music website. Must have been years ago now. When we started New World Next Week, I looked for just some intro-type music, just bumper music, and I found a bunch of different ones, and I sent them all to James Pilato and said, which one do you like? We both picked the same one independently, so that became the New World Next Week, and it was part of a series of themed bumper intros, 5 of them or something, so I use a different one of that same theme for the Corbett Report. I've had people send me in some bumper music before, so I use that for some of it. I've asked other people if I can use their music for the backgrounds. Lots of ways to do it. Most of it is free. Some of it you might pay to use the bumper music, but again, it's all out there online, and I certainly don't do any of it myself. So.
Sure. But just as another interesting note, you actually, for the Asia Pacific perspective, not the music, but the actual video intro was done by your good self. And I remember you painstakingly worked on that for
hours, yeah. It took hours to do. And it's ridiculous because it's about a 10-second intro. But, I wanted to make sure that I got representative clips from around Asia and some of the ones in my own bag of tricks. And then also a video from a stock footage site, I think, were one or two are in there as well. So.
Okay, this segues nicely into my next question. We've spoke of the free work you can get, the free music you can get from free archive websites, etc. Have you ever had any copyright issues, i.e. with using video thumbnails, like you might have a news clip that you put into podcast or in one of the videos? Or a particular video grab. Have you ever had any copyright issues or any kind of dramas with that?
Only in the YouTube auto-detect, because people who haven't used YouTube, they have a system now that's actually quite creepy, is that once you upload, it instantly can verify it against the entire archive of user-defined content in the YouTube archives. So if you use, for example, a clip from Al Jazeera, say, it will instantly, once you upload that, it will detect it's from Al Jazeera and flag that on your account. Each different content provider has different rules that they have for the ways that that affects your video. Some of them, they'll block it in certain countries. Some of them will just block it altogether. Some of them, it will be fine, but you have to put an ad on your video that will then go to their pocket. So I try to avoid that as much as possible. I don't use Al Jazeera clips, for example, for that reason. Everything I do is fair use and is governed by fair use, and it's news aggregation and comment. Right. So that's absolutely fair game. So I don't look at it in that way, but when you deal with something like YouTube, they have their own system and their own rules, which is why we have to get off the YouTube monopoly. But
sure. Speaking of that, you know, just on my side, for instance, when I do put up a lot of stories, whether it be from Strat Risks or whatever, it's, you know, it's important to always, or I always at least put the, you know, where you got the article from, and if you can, do a bit of digging and try and find the most original source that you can. And also, it's always good just to provide that in the bottom. That kind of covers your backside a little bit as well. If if anyone from these outlets decide to cause an issue, you can always say, well, look, on the bottom. Oh, but of course, you always have to be willing to take it down as well if needed.
Yeah.
You know. So.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's always a negotiation. And while we're talking, it seems the Oompa Loompas have invaded. So let's just see if we can get some of them in the shot here. Say hello. Hello.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa.
Oh, genki desu ka?
Genki desu ka? Yokatta. See you. Oh, how cute. Well, I think we're probably going to be overrun here in a little while, so maybe we should start wrapping this up.
Pretty quickly. Okay, here's a good question that I had. How do you best cope with the inevitable and sometimes personal attacks and criticism that comes with the territory of putting out sometimes controversial information?
Yeah, exceptionally important question. So, this is one of the most important questions because it is something that will affect people. I mean, this is the difference between sitting in the bleachers making comments and actually putting yourself out there, is that criticism will come. Criticism of the way you speak, the way you look, the way you dress, the things that you say, the things that you don't say, the way your room looks. Every possible conceivable angle of criticism that one could possibly imagine from a piece of media I have received multiple times over the years and continue to receive on a daily basis. So if I were the type of person whose self-validation came from other people, it would be exceptionally difficult to do this. If I took that kind of criticism from anonymous strangers on the internet seriously, I would probably not be able to do this. So it requires a certain toughness of skin, thickness of skin, which I'm not sure I can really coach people on. But I think that it has to be taken for what it is. And literally, we're dealing with people who all over the world, who are people you have never met and probably never will, who are anonymous YouTube users and could be paid government shills for all you know.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no way to know.
No.
But still, I mean, we have to treat it for what it's worth when criticism comes. And to my mind, the most difficult part of it is not just dealing with getting criticized. I could care less than that. But to be able to differentiate real, valid criticism from just the usual kind of peanut gallery hollering, and to be able to incorporate that in a meaningful way. And it's a fine line to walk, because I don't want to adjust what I'm doing in order to respond to criticism. I've seen that happening time and time again with a lot of different media producers over the years who get into this and then immediately start making videos to counteract their critics, and they start engaging with this or that commenter. And I think that's a complete derailment, and that's exactly what the point of a lot of that criticism is to derail you from what you're trying to do. I have my own task, my own ideas, my own concepts that I want to put forward. And if and when valid criticism comes in, I will address that and incorporate that. But it's a question of not deterring from what you actually want to accomplish and deterring from your objectives. On the other side, that means that we shouldn't ignore criticism or ignore topics that have been criticized because we don't want to be deflected from it. I mean, it's this weird cycle that you can get into. I mean, you really have to have a strong sense of the message that you want to give out and not deter from that. except to adapt to valid criticism. So it's a difficult line to walk, and you know, it's something that I have to negotiate with every day, and I still have to deal with criticism that comes in, and well, what is this valid? Is it reasonable? Is this person doing this in a spirit of constructive criticism, or is it just meant as a type of insult? And again, it does require a certain toughness or thickness of skin, so it's not for the faint of heart. It's not for people who are easily prone to crying wildly every time they receive a bit of criticism, as I'm sure you've probably experienced a bit yourself.
A wee bit. I mean, the worst criticism I've had so far that wasn't constructive was that I look like, my beard looks like Zangief from the Street Fighter video game. So I will take that as a compliment.
That is.
A gamer myself.
That's not bad.
But another comment said, just Brock, you need to slow down with your speech. And absolutely, I totally agree. And at home when I'm recording videos and interviews and stuff, I have a big sign behind me saying, slow down, breathe, speak slowly. You know, and it's something that you have to work on, and none of us are perfect. We're not here with my horses. And yeah, so, you know, thank you to those people who do give honest, constructive criticism, because that's the only way we get better. And hopefully it's those people also will learn it if they choose to do their own websites.
Exactly right. Mm. And that, again, that's another reason why I think if we're all part of the conversation, then none of us feel like we're just in the peanut gallery giving comments. We're all part of the process and all actively, constructively working towards something. And then we can all relate as people who are producing as well as commenting. So,
two more and we'll finish it up.
Okay, all right.
Okay. James, you are coined as the hardest working man in alternative media. And so, what are the realistic hours that James Corbett does in any given week? Not just your podcasting, recording interviews, but responding to emails and also, you know, writing international forecasting, for example.
Yeah, that's a good question. Tallying up the hours would be difficult. I'm blessed to be able to do this full time, so I get to set my own hours, which is helpful because now that I'm a stay-at-home dad, during the day I spend a lot of time with my son, and during the night I spend a lot of time on the website. So I am often, in fact, usually up till 3 or 4 in the morning working on the website, and then get a few hours sleep, wake up with my son. Usually get a nap sometime in the afternoon when I start to physically crash because I can't physically keep my eyes open anymore, and then around the evening time start to back to work on the website. So that's generally the routine, and that's pretty much 6 days a week at this point, 5 or 6. And so it's a lot of hours. I don't know, I couldn't add it up, but it's probably not even the best way to organize my time, but it's what I've fallen into, the routine I've fallen into. So I will probably be adjusting that as my son grows and develops and his routine and needs change, so will mine. So it's something that's in flux, but it has been an exceptional investment of time over the years, and I can't even begin to say how much time it took in the, especially when I was working a full-time job as well. So it's, again, it's not something that I ever would have done for any other reason than I truly believe in what I'm doing and spreading this work, this knowledge, as far as I can. And I don't take myself exceptionally seriously, but I take the information exceptionally seriously. So that's the motivation for me, and that's why I've sacrificed as much as I have to try to bring it to people. And and I think that that's the only real true place that this media can really come from in a productive way. If you don't have that, then you might dip your toe into it for a week or two and give up, but unless you're motivated by that kind of passion, it won't continue.
Absolutely, I'm exactly the same. You know, this Asia Pacific perspective is, you know, one of the things that I've really been proud of, that I've stuck out, and that's, and it's not difficult to stick at it. I mean, it is. I'm not doing anywhere near the kind of hours that you are, but it is a constant thing. It is almost a daily thing. You have to balance it out. But the knowledge of the importance of the information that we are getting out there, and you know, and spreading that information, really is the kicker. It is the reason why you and I do what we do, and also all the other excellent work out there.
Yep.
All right, James, let's wrap this up.
All right.
Your Oompa Loompas, I understand, are working on a time machine. Once that's completed in 2025, you can travel back in time. What are 3 key things that you know now that you wish you knew back at the start? What would you tell the starry-eyed, cherub-faced James Corbett of 7 years ago to make his life that much easier?
Oh, my God, that's a good question. That's an excellent question. And I should have a very good answer to this, but I haven't.
It doesn't have to be 3. Maybe 1.
Well, I'm trying to think. I'll give you as many as I can think of. I suppose the best thing that I've ever learnt or ever done is the fact that I haven't treated the Corbett Report with the type of perfectionism that I've often striven for in my other endeavors in life. And that is somewhat unusual because I tend to be a bit of a perfectionist with certain things. But with this, with the website, I knew just intuitively that I wanted to get it up and out as quickly as possible in obviously with as much quality as I can. But there has to be a trade-off between quality and perfection, because perfectionism truly is procrastination. If we just continue to put it off, oh, I can fine-tune it a little more, it will take forever. I mean, you could literally work on a single podcast for 18 years and it'll still never be perfect. So there has to be a point at which you make that decision. And I think I've learned over the years the balance in that. And I hope that that's constantly something that I'm refining, to try to make sure that the quality level is as good as possible while still continuing to meet the kind of weekly schedule, etc. And that's something that I've had to learn the hard way over time. I'm not sure how I would put that in a piece of advice for my younger self or for the younger podcasters out there, other than to say that perfectionism, and also I think there is a tendency for everyone, myself included, when they start out, if you're not getting a million views overnight, it's like, what the hell? Why this should be massive, and this report is the most important thing in the world. Why isn't it getting more views? And I think there is a tendency for younger podcasters and people starting out with this to want the work that they're doing at the moment, in that exact moment, to be as big as possible. And rightly so. I mean, we should be striving to make this seen as widely as possible. But don't let that get you down. I've seen people, for example, spend months putting together one video, and they release that video and it gets maybe a few hundred, maybe a few thousand views, and they're like, what the hell? I've put so much work into this. And for me, I'm putting out videos, you know, four or five times a week, and I think, sure, I think all of them should be million views, best viral videos, but of course they're not all going to be. And the one of the things that has really consistently surprised me over the years is you can never ever tell, we're out of video there, so we're going to go here. You can never, ever tell what's going to be a viral video or not, what's going to take on with the audience or not. Every single time I think, I don't know if this podcast connected, I'm not sure people are going to like it. I get consistently the best feedback about those podcasts in particular. I have no way of telling. So I think just continue to do it, put out as much as you can, but obviously don't sacrifice the quality in order to do so. It's a fine line, but just keep at it and continue and continue and continue and press forward. And it's fire and forget in the info war. It really is. And you never know what you plant, the seed you plant today, how it's going to flower tomorrow, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, who knows? And I've got things that are way back in my archives from years ago that are suddenly going re-viral, like in the wake of the Boston bombing, I had a false flag video that went viral again. So you never know. You never know. And just keep at it. That's the number one advice.
I think never better advice has been spoken, James. So thank you so much for that. As always, time and technology seems to be the enemy of the podcaster today. So
this is real life, folks. This is what it looks like.
This is downtown Western Japan. So yeah. Thank you so very much for having me on, my friend. And yes, we unfortunately, as we said, we didn't get to all the questions that flooded in, so I'll make you a promise and I'll come back here and we'll do it again.
Hey? We definitely will. Absolutely. I insist. All right. Thank you all for tuning in for this. And once again, I will be trying to put out some kind of video this weekend, just showing a little bit of the setup as well physically, so you see what it's like. And you see my palatial multi-$1 million recording studio, right? Yeah. So again, it's very simple to do. It's all do-it-yourself. I taught every single piece of this technology to myself. I didn't have any formal instruction in this. If I can do it, I guarantee you guys can do it out there. So that's going to be it for this edition of the podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. I'm your host, James Corbett, with my good friend Brock West, apperspective.net. Be there or be square. And on that note, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you again next week. Fake. All right. Sorry, guys. Just one more thing I thought I should add at the end of this podcast before I go. Brock will be in town here in the sunny climes of Western Japan for another couple of days before he moves on his Japanese vacation. So we are going to be painting the town brown, as they say back in Newcastle, where my parents are from, this weekend. And we're going to be doing some karaoke and other shenanigans. So that will be the subscriber-only video this month and the subscriber newsletter. So if you want to sign up for the subscriber newsletter, if
you're not yet doing so. Of course, you can go to corbettreport.com/support to listen to the dulcet tones of Brock West or the off-key caterwauling of James Corbett as we do karaoke and other fun stuff. So you can check that out. Once again, I do want to thank you all for your support and for, of course, tuning in for this episode, and I really do hope that it helps you to at least begin to answer some of your questions. I know that this is only a partial answer to those questions, and we'll have to continue talking about this, and I will be putting out a video in the future showing, actually physically showing the setup of some of this stuff that we've been talking about, and I hope you can use the links to start creating some of this media for yourselves, because once again, I'm hoping this isn't just a one-way conversation. At any rate, that is going to do it for this week, so thanks again for your time, and looking forward to talking to you again next week.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by The Corbett Report Subscriber, a weekly newsletter featuring James Corbett's international forecaster editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report DVDs, and once a month, a subscriber-only video. Sign up today to start receiving your copy at corbettreport.com/support.